Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Coming up on the show today, pro hockey player turned professional poker player Greg Mueller, who you may have seen this summer doing some hand analysis during the World Series of Poker coverage on ESPN. And we've also got the 2006 World Series main event champion Jamie Gold coming up on the show today, plus details on the Harrah's St. Louis Gateway Poker Classic, which is just 2 days away. Hello, I am Paul Harrah, sitting in the poker room of Harrah's St. Louis, where the Bad Beat jackpot is $118,000, and there are lots of cash games full of people trying to win the jackpot and beat their opponents as well, plus tournament action going on all around me. And my partner, Dennis Phillips, is out in Las Vegas. Hi, Dennis, how are you?
I'm enjoying life, Paul. A little cold, believe it or not, I got down in the 40s last night in Vegas.
Wow, so we're right on the same level here.
All right. Cool.
Hey, before we get into anything else today, and we have a lot of stuff to cover, I talked to you just about 24 hours ago, and you said you were on your way to go play in a new kind of poker tournament, something called position poker. I've never heard of this. You told me what it was a little bit beforehand, but explain it to our audience and tell us what the experience was like.
Well, everybody's trying to get a little bit of a new twist, something else, something to create interest for the players in that. And down at the Bellagio, they've got their WPT coming up and their High Roller 100K coming up. But they're leading it off. The first two events were both a little bit different. The first one that I did not play in was had three first days, 1A, 1B, 1C. That's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And what they did is you were allowed to play in all three of those. And then whoever survived it could come back on day two and get this, combine any chips they had left from any of the days. So if you played all three and you had chips at the end of each of those 3 days, you didn't take the biggest stack or anything. You combined all three of those together and started out day two with everything and all those chips in front of you.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that before. I didn't even know that was going on, actually. I talked to some of the players yesterday, and they said it was crazy. There's one guy that came in there with a huge amount. He survived all three, and he had like 400,000 or something starting out on day two.
Well, you know what? You know, it's interesting because I'm always interested in the strategy of tournament poker. You play it much more. I'm a cash game player. You're a tournament player, so maybe you can fill me in on this. Let's say you go and you play in 1A of an event like that, and you have a great day, and you emerge as if not the chip leader, one of the chip leaders. Do you sit back and do nothing on 1B and 1C and just wait for day two, or do you try to go in and amass even more chips so that you can have a tremendous amount, but of course you have to buy in again for 1B and 1C? What would you do?
Well, again, that's what you've got to analyze and what you're trying to do and what your goal is. Are you just trying to cash and maybe creep up a little bit, or are you trying to win the whole thing? If you would actually go in, I don't know this for a fact, but I would bet, if you went in and bought in on 1A, 1B, 1C, those three buy-ins combined is a little over $1,000. I would bet you the money started at like 700 or something, so that you could actually buy in all 3 days, make a cash, and still lose money. Not a good scenario. Okay?
Yeah, that's right.
So you've got to be a little careful on that. But if you're going in there to try and make that final table, then and you have a good first day, then you know, obviously I think you would try to come back either at least one of the other 2 days just to accumulate more chips, because it's free chips. It's adding to it, and you can play it totally different than you did the first day. You're just trying to survive it and add another 40, 50, 60,000 in chips to your stack. It brings up a lot of different scenarios. It absolutely does. If I would go in there on day 1A and get busted out and make nothing, then I may not come back for days B and C. I don't know. If you miss days A and B, do you even go to C then because of that? It's something I'd never heard of before of anybody doing. But, you know, I'll get some feedback from the players over the next couple of days. I'll see what they thought of it, how they liked it. Doug Lee, a gentleman who's had some success in poker, good guy. I was talking to him. He played day 1A, accumulated about $120,000 and never came back for B and C. He said, no, I'm satisfied with that. I'll just wait. And I think when I left there last night, there were 13 people left, and he was still one of them. Mm-hmm. And at that time, had over $700,000. So it worked for him, just playing the one day, getting a nice solid stack and sitting back.
You know, you talked about the min cash. You could play all 3 days and min cash and end up losing money. On the circuit events now, and I found this out at Hammond when I was up there for the big one with 3,001 people in it, they've increased the amount you get as a min cash. It was a $350 buy-in, but a min cash was $777, and the reason they do that is because it's a re-entry event, and they have so many people play day 1A, bust out, and come back on day 1B. So I wonder if they're adjusting things like that at the Bellagio for an event like this to encourage people to buy in. And so when you min cash, you actually are making a little bit more than what 3 days of buy-ins would have cost you.
Oh, that's very possible. Again, I don't know the structure. I don't know what the payouts were. I'll actually check that out. That's a curious, very good question. This is new to me, too, and I did not play in it. But it does ring up. There's so much thought going into these games now and how you play them and the difference between them. It brings me back to the your original question on the position poker.
Because
that was another innovation that they did there. What that is after the first hand, whoever wins the hand then gets prime position for the next hand. Basically, he plays after the button. In between the button and the small blind is where he's now positioned. And Matt, you know, he doesn't physically get up and sit there. But that's where he would actually, you know, play in order.
So are you then last to act in all rounds or just pre-flop?
No, you're last to act in after the flop, the turn, and the river, and you act after the button pre-flop, but before the small and big blind. So it gives you a chance pre-flop to steal the blinds, and then it gives you position after the flop to make a C-bet or, you know, whatever you want to do. It does help you out in that way. And if you're an aggressive player, a person that likes to steal a lot of blinds, likes to see a lot of pots, this can be an advantage to you.
So it effectively turns the button into the cutoff. So, you know, if it's folded around to the button and the button thinks, all right, I'm going to just raise it up here and steal the blinds. No. There's still the guy who won the previous hand who has position on you as the button.
And can re-steal it. Exactly. And then he's going to have position on you on every other turn, on the flop, on the turn, and on the river.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
big difference.
So how was it for you in playing a tournament like that?
They need to work on it a little bit more. The dealers, this is new to them. Some of them had to take time and made a couple. There was one exception to it because he didn't want to penalize a guy for winning a hand. Therefore, if he was the big blind on the next hand, he got to act in turn. He didn't jump in front of the small blind. All right? And act, that was the only exception to it. If you were the big blind and won the position button, then you acted in just normal and you acted after the small blind. Other than that, then you were always acting after the button.
Right.
But what I noticed there, it didn't make a whole lot of difference in the first few levels where the blinds really weren't worth stealing. There was an aggressive guy at my table, and he won the button a lot of times, or the position button, and was making a lot of continuation bets and everything. And he accumulated a lot of chips, but he also got involved in a couple hands and lost a lot of chips. So, you know, it kind of worked both ways with the. But when you got into the later rounds, where there was significant value in taking the blinds and the antes, then it really did make a difference. It was worthwhile to try and win that position button. It was worthwhile to get in it to where you could steal the blinds. Huge difference.
So does that mean that it changes the way you play because you're not only playing to win the pot, you're also trying to win position in the next hand?
Oh, yeah, and after you have the position, you want to protect it. I saw, again, the aggressive guys end up winning the position one, two, and three times in a row. So made a big difference. It did there at the end. The problem I didn't like was it seemed to slow down the play an awful lot. Everybody was hesitating and was not, you know, is it my turn to act? Even after playing this for 2 or 3 hours, guys still weren't catching on to it and were folding out a turn just by instinct.
Uh-huh.
You know, years and years of times when the guy to your right folds, then you fold. No, the position guy is in between you if you're the small blind and the button. So we saw that quite a bit. And a couple of times I saw exactly what you described earlier, where the button would make a raise and then suddenly it would go over to the position button and the guy would go, oops. You could just see it. He didn't physically say it, but you could just see it in the back of his mind going, oh, man, I forgot about that guy.
How did you do in the tournament? And how many people were in it, by the way?
There was only about 100 people in it. But, again, it seemed to be very slow and very there was 10,000 for starting chips. They started it out at 50 and 100, so they didn't start real low, 40-minute levels. So it progressed up there, but it took forever. We literally played through, I couldn't even begin to tell you, 10 levels and still had half the field there.
Wow.
Whereas normally you're down to maybe 20% of the field. So it just seems to take people a lot longer to act. For that, I wasn't in favor of it. Maybe as they get more familiar, maybe as the dealers become more familiar, it'll work a little better. But all in all, I'll go back to the regular no limit, I think.
Yeah. Wait until they figure it out, and maybe you have to do a little bit more thinking, as I'm sure a lot of the players do, about, you know, here's a new concept. What's optimum strategy?
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. It's kind of like when being able to straddle the button became the new thing, taking away position from the blinds pre-flop. That changes the dynamic of a table considerably. And when that happened, I know, at least here in St. Louis, when it happened for the first time several years ago, you know, first of all, you had people, again, folding out a turn, but also trying to figure out what happens here. How do you do it? What's the optimum time to do it? When do you do it? What if everybody's doing it? What if only a couple of guys are doing it? So as with any new concept, it takes a while to think through what are the options and what are the best strategies.
Yeah, but I love the ideas that they're bringing in these little new innovations. Even if they don't work, they're trying to twist the game, bring in new strategy, new thought levels, and making people work to finish deep in these tournaments. It's kind of cool, actually. I like it.
All right. As I said, we have lots of stuff to get to on the show today. We have one interesting story that's kind of a follow-up to something we told you about a couple of months ago when some big-name Hollywood poker players got a lawsuit delivered to their doors because they had been playing in these home games, not really in anybody's home. They were being played in places like the Four Seasons or the Beverly Hills Hilton or some of these big famous hotels in fancy suites up there with food and drink and all sorts of other things. And guys like Ben Affleck and Gabe Kaplan and Tobey Maguire and Matt Damon and some of the others would play in these relatively high-stakes games. And we told you that there was one of the guys who was playing in these games, a guy by the name of Bradley Ruderman, who is now doing 10 years in prison because he got caught running a Ponzi scheme to pay off some of his poker debts. He had ripped off people for somewhere between $25 and $30 million. Well, the victims got an attorney, and they want to try to recoup as much of this money as possible, and so that attorney filed a lawsuit against 22 people, including Gabe Kaplan and Tobey Maguire, who had won in these Hollywood home games. And the concept of the lawsuit, as I understood it, was the games are illegal, therefore you are gaining money illegally. They are ill-gotten gains, and therefore you have no right to them, and they should go to the people who were ripped off by the Ponzi scheme in the first place. Whether that has merit to it or not, Tobey Maguire didn't want to find out. He has settled for $80,000. They had sued him for more than $300,000 he had won in these Hollywood home games. He settled last week for $80,000, as did 13 other people. Gabe Kaplan agreed to pay about $27,000 after he was sued to try to recoup nearly $63,000 in winnings from these games. Now, there are two things here. One is, I'm amazed that anybody really kept track of how much everybody won so that you could go back later and find that out. To me, that's a bad home game if there are those kind of records being kept that somebody could subpoena and find out and then use against you. Most people who play in home games don't want anybody on the outside to know anything about that game. And the other part of this is, would you, if you were Tobey Maguire, have agreed to just settle this thing to make it go away, Dennis?
Well, a couple of different things in it. Actually, I think that this gentleman, this Brad Ruderman, it was 25, 30 million, not for sure how much. I think he was living the high style. I don't think he went to the poker games to recoup some of that money that he had stolen in the Ponzi scheme. I think he was looking on that the same thing as he would look on a luxury call or a vacation to wherever or whatever. He was just spending money and having fun. But, and again, on the records, we don't know that there were records kept for sure or not. I think they made guesstimates, based maybe on conversations with Brad Ruderman, who were the big winners and how much did they win and this and that. So we don't know if there were or weren't. I would hope there weren't any. I don't have any inside knowledge there. I would hope there were not any specific records kept, you know, and they, you know, checked people as they went out the door how much money they have in their pocket or some such crap. But they were guessing that, you know, Tobey Maguire won $300,000 and Gabe won $60,000 and whatever. So anytime then that you go back and try and reclaim this, something is better than nothing. So I think there was a reasonable discussion between attorneys and they agreed on these particular figures and drop the thing and walk on. I can see why Toby would do it. I actually think, had it gone to court, two things would have happened. I think he would have won. I don't think he'd have had to pay anything. But I think he would have got some really negative publicity. This is Tobey Maguire. You've made millions in doing all this other stuff. These other people lost their life savings. You know, how can you keep this money type stuff? I think it probably was worth him to pay the $80,000 to get out from under it, to just walk away and not get any of the negative. And he might even get some positive feedback from this.
Plus, when you're a guy who's played Spider-Man in three movies and you've got all these other things that you've done, you're probably worth nine figures, $100 million, $200 million, who knows what the guy's worth.
Well,
$80,000 is not all that much money. There is the concept of, well, I'm not guilty and so I shouldn't have to pay a thing, but I think you're right. Why go through it if you can make something like this go away? I mean, if you or I were sued and we could make it go away for $80, we would.
I mean, I'm thinking so.
I'm just putting it in the same scale. $80 $80,000 Tobey Maguire. It's about the same thing, right?
Okay, cool. That's a good way to put it.
Okay, also in the news, we found out yesterday that Congressman Barney Frank, who has been very pro-legalization of online gaming, is going to retire from Congress at the end of next year. I had several people email me when they saw the news about this saying, this is probably bad for online poker legislation. I disagree because I think that it has moved past Barney. First of all, Barney was in favor of all gaming online being legal. Craps, roulette, slots, blackjack. He wanted all of that to be legal, not just poker, which I think hurt poker's cause and its argument as a skill game. But secondly, Barney hadn't been that effective in moving things out of the House Financial Services Committee, which he was chairman of when the Democrats were in charge in the Congress and is now the ranking minority member on, now that the Republicans are running the House. But he hadn't moved it forward as much as we're seeing other things going on. He was a great spokesperson, don't get me wrong, and I hate to lose that, but I don't think that it's going to necessarily hurt the cause of getting licensed, regulated, legal online poker in the United States. What do you say?
Well, I was lucky enough to actually meet Representative Franks a number of times. I had dinner with him in Washington and a couple of other people. Let me tell you, first of all, I have a lot of respect for him. This man is extremely intelligent and extremely knowledgeable. And I just have a lot of respect for the gentleman because of that. Seeing him retire, I think the House will be a poorer place by him retiring. A lot of influence. A lot of things he's done positive. You bring a couple of key points that you're exactly right on. He is a libertarian. In his opinion, government has no place telling us what and where and how we can gamble and do this stuff. You can have your little social amendments to it so you keep underage people and things like that away from it, and you make sure that it's fair for everybody. But the government should not be intruding upon that aspect of our life, be it blackjack, be it craps, be it online poker, be it whatever. So that was his opinion, and that's what he fought for, and he made no secret of it. And I have to respect him for that. I also will agree with you that with the shift in the government and him not being in the majority leader anymore for his committee, it made it a little more difficult for him to bring something up. And I do think that there are enough people on board, and he has raised it up and the knowledge and the information to the other representatives, the other senators now, that it can go forth without Barney Frank. But we will be indebted to him for championing it to start with, for his own reasons maybe, but still championing it. And I'm telling you, I was impressed in my meeting with him. Didn't think I would be. Frankly, I had an eye-opener. The gentleman is extremely intelligent.
Very smart and very funny.
Yeah, he can be, absolutely.
Yeah. He was a good one. We had him on the show at the World Series about a year and a half ago. Couldn't be a nicer guy. Obviously had a lot of business that was on his mind, but took a few minutes to talk to us and was really a pleasure. And I'll miss him in Congress, but I don't think the cause of online poker is going to be damaged all that much. All right, we've got Greg Mueller coming up in just a couple of minutes. First, I promised you a rundown of events for the Gateway Poker Classic, which starts Thursday night here at Harris St. Louis. The first event is the Jack and Jill event that we told you about, $125 for each member of a two-person team. Got to be a man and a woman. And, by the way, some of the better female players in St. Louis tell me they've been approached more than a dozen times by guys who say, hey, you want to play in that event with me? You want to play in that event with me? You want to play in that event with me? None of them has taken it up yet. I think they're waiting for somebody to buy them in, because if you could free roll into the event, why not? Anyway, that'll be the first event, and then Friday at noon will be the first of the noon events. And people have also been asking about structure on all of these things. So I'm going to run down that for you as well. First of all, there are going to be 30 different events. There's an $1,100 championship event, a six max event, a turbo event, and 16 more no limit hold'em events. There's a horse event, three pot limit Omahas, two pot limit Omaha high low, one limit Omaha high low, one pot limit Omaha triple chance event, the Jack and Jill, the ladies, and the senior event. The noon events will kick off on Friday with a $355 buy-in. You will get $10,000 in chips for that. It's a two-day event because they're expecting enough of a field to keep it going through Friday and Saturday. If you don't play in that one or you bust out on day one, then on Saturday you've got another noon event that's a $565 buy-in where you get $12,000 in chips. You will also, if you play the main event, get $20,000 in chips. If you play any of the 5 p.m. events, and that's where a lot of the PLO and horse and other events will take place, you'll start with $5,000 in starting chips for a buy-in of $245. And then every evening, there'll be a 7 o'clock no-limit hold'em tournament with a $125 buy-in. If you work all day long and you want to come play poker at night, that's a $125 buy-in. You'll get $3,000 in chips, and it'll go from there. The levels will be 30 minutes for almost every one of these events, except the first event this Friday, the second noon event this Saturday, the other 565 No Limit Hold'em event, which is on Thursday, December 8th, and the No Limit Hold'em Championship on Saturday, December 10th. Those will all have 40-minute rounds. There's also the Turbo event with 20-minute rounds, etc. If you come into the Harrah St. Louis Poker Room, you can walk right up to the podium and ask for a list of the structures, the starting chips, the buy-ins, and all the rest. The full schedule is also linked from our blog. If you go to the Final Table blog on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, you can find out about what, when, where, how much, etc. I'll be playing in a couple of these events, also hoping that we'll get some great cash action going here. Dennis, I know you're going to try to come in for a couple of events between other obligations you have, right?
Absolutely. We're going up to the Peppermill this weekend and then down to Oklahoma the following weekend. I'm going to see. This is going to be interesting. American Airlines is going to really get to know me if this happens. But, yeah, I'm going to try and make it back there. Try my darndest to be back there.
All right, let's take a very quick break here, and then Greg Mueller will join us. He did some hand analysis for the main event on ESPN this fall. We'll talk to him about that and much more when we come back with the Final Table Poker Radio Show from Las Vegas and Harrah's St. Louis on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
Kids, are you caught up in that old game of shuffling your debt around and hoping you'll get lucky and win the jackpot? Well, it's time to deal. Mortgage rates are low and savings are high. So stop bluffing and call 800-GRANNY-8 or go to granny8.com. You bet our friendly loan officers make it easy, and we don't have an application fee. So call 800-GRANNY-8 and you'll be holding all the aces.
8 mortgage rates. Call 800-GRANNY-8.
Granny8.com.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, brought to you by Harris St. Louis and Homestead Financial Mortgage. For great rates, call 800-GRANNY-8. The Gateway Poker Classic starts this Thursday here at Harris St. Louis. We hope to see you here. With Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas, I am Paul Harris in the Harris St. Louis Poker Room, and we're joined now by Greg Mueller. I don't know any professional poker players who became professional hockey players, but Greg went from being a pro hockey player to a pro poker player, and it's paid off for him with 19 cashes at the World Series of Poker, including two bracelets back in 2009. He's also made a WPT final table, earned something like $1.7 million in tournaments. And you may have seen him this fall analyzing a couple of hands during ESPN's coverage of the main event. Greg, we're happy to welcome you to our final table.
What's going on, boys?
So, Greg, are you up in Canada or are you down in Vegas?
Neither. I'm in Los Angeles. I'm at the Commerce Casino.
Oh, sweet. Okay, I've played at the Commerce a number of times. Lots of good action there. What game are you playing?
Well, it depends. I play pretty much every game, and so there's anything from no limit to Chinese poker to straight hold'em or mixed games. So it's the good news is about the Commerce is there's always a game to be played, even if some games are tougher or weaker, there's all different types of poker, so there's always generally lots of action.
Pretty cool.
Sweet.
Greg, I mentioned that you did some hand analysis on ESPN for their coverage of the main event, and I thought you did a terrific job there. Tell us a little bit about how that happened, who chose the hands, and some other behind-the-scenes information.
Well, it was fairly tough to do for me because normally I have no problems babbling away or being kind of funny on the spot or whatever, but it was so tough because it wasn't like it was my buddies playing and I had to do an analysis on them. It was these people that had difficult names to pronounce. So when I was doing the analysis, instead of going, oh, there's Dennis, what is he doing in this hand? I was so focused on remembering their names that it made it really difficult to analyze the hands because I'm saying, Musami had this hand and Jameson had, and it was like, it made it a little bit more difficult for me. And so even though I had a lot of good feedback, I found myself not as loosey-goosey and more focused on remembering the names. And so that made it a little difficult, even though I had a good time and it turned out, pretty good. That was the difficult part for me is that they just picked, random hands with random people and it just happened to be that I never knew these people and never knew, their names or anything. So when I was looking at the hands to analyze them and watching them on ESPN with, to give the analysis, it was just difficult because I kept having to think of these guys' names,
Would Maurice Crew say, okay, here's the hand we've chosen for you, and then you would watch it and figure out what you wanted to say?
Yeah, pretty much like that. They had it down. They had a script for the hand, and then just said, what do you think about this hand, and who played good and who played bad, and so. It was more so not even that I could watch it so much, but more so on paper. And that made it even more difficult. If I'm sitting here watching, a Poker After Dark or a table with well-known poker players or buddies of mine, it'd be so easy to go, oh, look at Helmuth. Before he goes into his rant here, he does this. Or, Like, and it's so much easier to talk about my buddies and colleagues where I can joke around with them, throw inside jokes in there and know what they have and focus more on the hand than it is when you're doing that. Although, like I said, I would gladly do it again and had a blast doing it. It just made it a lot more difficult, especially for us poker players. We always got ADD kicking in, so.
I can sympathize 100% with you. They had me do an analysis, Poker Stars did, of a couple of the Latin American tournament final tables. And you talked about names interesting to produce, or to talk about. There's one guy that had 20 letters in his final name with no vowels. and every time I would hesitate that split second before I'd try to say his name. And it got to be a comic relief in the studio, because I could see his name coming up two lines down from what they're wanting me to read here, and know I have to get to it. And they could see the anticipation in my face. Talk about reading and tells.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh. Anyhow, so much fun, though. Always something different. So I thought you did a very good job. I thought you did, Antonio did, several other guys. Is this going to be a something new you want to try and get involved with ESPN? Are you going to become the new Marv Albert or something? Or
I wouldn't go that far, but no. I mean, I never shy away from the camera or doing interviews, even in my hockey days. You know, my last year I wore the C, and that meant I had to do a lot of interviews and stuff like that, press conferences, and I always enjoyed doing them. And you know, if it paved the way without schooling to sneak in some ways of doing it, I'd love to crack my foot in the door, kind of thing.
Greg, while we're talking about the main event, you were involved in a hand that became pretty infamous pretty quickly from day 1D, a hand involving an opponent and knowing what the other guy had because he showed you his cards before you folded, and then you decided to do something incredibly classy, and even though you had him beat, You mucked your hand. Can you go back and for our listeners who don't know the story, run through the details of that hand?
Sure. Always difficult for me when I'm playing the main events and have a dream table, which I happen to have. I always tend to get myself into big trouble because I think, beautiful, there's no online wizards, there's nobody I recognize. It's just a bunch of guys, like when Dennis first started out, that, you know, have their jobs and enjoy playing poker, a bunch of nice guys, and I'm just trying to run them over 24/7, and I'm just losing, and next thing you know, I start getting myself really low in chips. So there was a guy at my table to my left, really nice guy, actually reminded me a lot of Dennis, you know, just like talking sports and you know, talking to where he was from. I think he was from Chicago, and you know, just a really nice guy. But obviously, you know, he was an amateur, and so anyways, but he had his iPod on, you know, part of the time. So I get an ace king, and I'm in the big blind. He raises under the gun. Everybody folds, and it comes to me, and I didn't have enough chips to get too creative, so I said, I'll just take a flop and see what happens. So long story short, it comes three rags on the flop with two clubs. And I checked, and he checked behind me. So on the turn, the ace of clubs rolled off, and I had the ace king with no club, and I said, beautiful. I bet the turn pretty big, and he called. And I said, beautiful, he has ace-queen. If no club hits the river, I'm going to value bet this big. The river's a club, so I check. Now he makes a bet. I don't remember, to be honest with you, the exact denominations or whatever. Now I start talking to him, and I'm like, Jesus, you really have a club here? I know you got ace-queen, you get the queen of clubs. And I show him my ace-king. My intentions are to fold, but I haven't really done anything yet. I'm kind of just like, geez, you know, and all of a sudden, it's not to get an angle or anything. Like, my intentions are clearly to fold because I believe that he had ace-queen with a queen of clubs, but I'm still not 100% sure. Now, he doesn't know what's going on. He just shows me his ace-queen, and he's like, nope, didn't have it. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, in that case, maybe I'll just call. So I said, what are my options here to the dealer? And he says, I don't know. He calls the floor. And the floor comes over and says, well, your options, Greg, are call, fold, or raise. And I said, okay, but I'm not getting a penalty. I'm not, you know, because I wasn't doing it to get it, you know, it wasn't an angle. I wasn't trying to get information. My intentions, like I said, were to fold, but now he just randomly turns his hand over. So I just wanted to be very clear, if I called, was I going to get a penalty? And he said, nope, you can do whatever you want. And just kind of, you could tell he was busy. He was kind of, you know, encouraging me to do something. And I just looked at the situation, and I was like, you know, the pot was decent for me because I, like I said, had donked off most of my chips throughout the day, and could have really used this pot. And I looked at him, and he was such a nice guy, and he was being friendly, and he was, you know, he wasn't trying to needle me or juice me. He just had his iPod on, didn't, you know, assuming that I folded, and, you know, was proud of his play that he made, or maybe he was trying to show me thinking he had an ace. I mean, neither one of the two made sense, but he was just such a nice guy. I said, you know what? The right thing here to do is just to go with what I was originally going to do and just lay the hand down. And so then I just said, all right, I'll just fold it. He took the pot. And you know, in hindsight, I talked to, you know, a lot of players, and it was mixed. You know, some of them said, yeah, I mean, you were planning on folding, you should have folded. Others said, are you out of your mind? You're playing for $10 million. You're short in chips. This pot could have, you know, helped you get all kind, like, you know, it's huge when you have 10,000 or 20,000 in the early stages. That makes a big difference. And some of them said, are you out of your mind? How do you ever do that? You know, and I said, but this guy, like, was like from the rest of the day on, like, he was loving it. It was a great experience for him playing in the World Series rather than that being the negative turning point for him. You know, it was a positive turning point for him. Yeah, it cost me some chips, but as a person, I know he had a great experience at the end of the day. He, you know, asked me if he could take me to dinner one time, or if I'm ever in Chicago, call him. And, like, he just, you know, it made poker such more of a positive experience, and I thought it was the right thing to do. So, you know, that's why I did what happened, and you know, whatever. I did ask a lot of people because I was like, God, I sure need those chips, but I'm happy with what I did, you know.
That's quite a classy thing to do. It absolutely is. I would hope I would do the same thing, but I'm not sure I want to be in that position. You're right.
You know what? When I first heard the story, I had the exact same reaction. I said, boy, that's a really classy thing to do, and I'm not sure I would have done that. I try to play as classy a game as I possibly can, and if it were a cash game, it might be a little bit different, but it's the World Series main event, and you know, I'm a little short stacked, and that's going to increase my stack by 50 or 60%. I take my hat off to you for doing it. And you know what? You showed yourself as a great ambassador of the game, because that guy's reaction will help, and he'll tell other people about that, and that will help, because we have too many people who have the scumbag image in poker for being dirty, disgusting guys who call each other out at the table and yell at each other and get mad, particularly at amateurs, which makes no sense whatsoever. And you've been exactly the opposite of that in this circumstance, so I think it accrues to the positive in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, this guy was jacked up, and the poker economy is like the regular economy, I guess, is, you know, hurting, and, you know, we need more people in it, and great image for the game, and the more people we get. I mean, not that any of those things were going through my mind, but generally that's just what we, you know, what we had going on. I mean, I had a couple seconds to make my decision, and yeah, like, you know, I would much rather enjoy hearing from people that I'm a, you know, a good guy and a classic guy than to, you know, than to be frowned upon in a situation like this. So, you know, whatever, I've never cashed in the main event, so, you know, it's not like that was going to make a big difference. Probably, I've always struggled in the main event anyway. So,
all right, there. Go ahead, Dennis.
Well, just as a final note, if you had gone ahead and called or raised or whatever right there, it may never have made any news. It may have just been totally ignored. The fact that you did the right thing is positive for you. Got you positive feedback, as it should. I'm proud of you for doing the right thing, and it definitely helped bring the image of poker players up. I get so tired of the thing Paul was talking about. I go to charity events, poker events. I see these guys. They're doing the right thing. They're donating their time, their money, their energy for good causes. Poker is a group of people that 90% of them are great guys. They really are. There are a few exceptions, as in any time you get a group, but you just proved that you're one of them up at the top there, Greg. So thanks a lot.
Oh, thanks.
Now we got to talk about something ugly.
Uh-oh.
One thing I did not mention in your intro, Greg, is that you were a full tilt pro, which I guess we need to clarify up front means you were an employee, not a shareholder, right?
No, I mean, I'll be honest, I own the whole company. No, yeah, I'm kidding. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I was strictly employed, had nothing to do with, you know, any of the finances or anything like that.
So what has your reaction been to what's happened, not just what happened in the weeks after Black Friday where they couldn't pay their players back, but with the recent indictments and the new news that the group Bernard Tapie is trying to buy it if they can make a deal with the DOJ? How do you take this?
Well, to be totally honest with you, I never really read the forums So I never really know in depth of exactly what's going on. People are always like, even back home, when I'm at home, they're like, oh, man, I heard about Full Tilt. So what's going to happen? So what's going on? So what's this? And I'm always like, and then some people are like, oh, yeah, you work for the company. You don't want to say anything bad. It's not that. I just don't like talking out of my rear end, and I don't know anything. Like, the bottom line is I'm not afraid to talk bad. I'm not afraid to talk good. Here's how I see it. I see it as obviously there's a lot of mistakes made in handling, you know, the business. I don't believe for one minute that it was intentionally or scamming. It was just like if all of a sudden somebody announced in you know, the city of St. Louis that the local bank was going to go out of business, I just believe the entire city would run up the next day and try and get their money, and they might not have that much cash sitting there. The difference is, you know, the bank would stay open extended hours, or they would say, come back tomorrow and get your cash. Don't worry, you can have your money. And this is, you know, these are the types of things that I believe that Full Tilt right from the start should have handled differently. You know, like I know obviously some of the guys, you know, like Howard and the guys, and to me they've always, you know, been great people and good poker players and honorable and honest. And so I can't obviously speak from the business end of things, what was going on, because I don't know. But I said it back then, and I truly, truly still believe it. Not to the point where I would back it, cover it, or buy any online money. But I, like a good friend of mine that I travel on the circuit with, Sean Buchanan, has a ton of money on there. And I always say I honestly believe he's going to, you know, I believe everybody's going to get their money. Because, you know, the only thing that I think that they handled wrong is that they should have come right out and said, listen, we never expected this to happen and didn't have the funds in there. Like, just own up to the mistake and say, but we will have your funds, ASAP type of thing. And then, you know, maybe before the damage was done, as far as, you know, the image of Full Tilt, maybe sell to a share, like sell to somebody, you know, take the value of the company and lose some of the profits, obviously, but have the company up and running like PokerStars did, where, you know, that obviously took a hit to pay entire accounts out, but now they're up and running again and business is back to usual minus the states. And, you know, that's the only difference, is rather than just being silent and this and this and that, I believe the intentions were there, but because of all the negative publicity, it's just made it that much more difficult, I think.
Well, I agree with you almost everything there. I'm not for sure where this is going to go, and I'm not for sure what the tax implications and everything else is going to happen. There's a lot of things to be ironed out. But I truly do believe that the guys that were running Full Tilt, and some of them are friends of mine, will try to find a way to make sure the players get their money back. And absolutely, it was not set up in any kind of, and I hate to even mention it, Ponzi scheme. There's not a chance in the world this was set up that way.
No, it's just that you have to imagine if you have a, you know, this is, again, this is me being ignorant from the business standpoint and trying to explain it for simple people like myself when it comes to business, is that you have to imagine, let's say, people on Full Tilt, let's say the total dollar value is $150 million sitting there. Well, I guess in the sense of business ways, you're supposed to have $150 million sitting in the bank ready to pay out at any time. But obviously, nobody's going to cash out all at once. Why would they? They have people cashing out up to maybe, you know, $5 million a day or $10 million or $20, and I'm sure they had the reserves in there to pay up to $20 million or $30 million or whatever. And all of a sudden, boom, after this happened with the DOJ, everybody hit the cash out button the next day, and it was just like, what are we going to do? Well, rather than paying out everybody, you know, half their money, or paying out people under $10,000 all their money, you know, the little people, and just keeping the bit, you know, they should, like, that's what I would have done if I would have had, you know, $30 million in there and there was $150 million out there. I would have paid all the small accounts just so that the majority of the publicity goes away, and just tell the big players, be patient, you're going to get your money. We weren't expecting the tsunami to hit Full Tilt, and you know, we will get you your cash, just be a little patient. And then that way people can understand and not panic, and then maybe somebody's interested in buying and otherwise what seems like to be a, you know, successful company type of thing.
But I don't think the problem was just a matter of did they have enough money in there. And there are questions about that at times. I think a lot of the anger is from the the allegations that these guys paid themselves out of player money, that they didn't keep it segregated, that there wasn't, okay, the player money, which is in, you know, a lockbox, to use an Al Gore term, that will only get touched when we're playing, when we're paying the players back, and we'll take the money out of the rake, out of the profit from the company, and we'll pay ourselves out of that. The fact that the funds got commingled, I think that that's a lot of the problem that Howard and Chris and the other guys found themselves falling into.
Yeah, I have no idea, you know, where they were paying themselves out of, how much they were getting. You know, obviously you hear all kinds of rumors and allegations and stuff, but, I mean, I see these guys are wearing, they're not walking around in fancy suits, they're just wearing their jeans, and, you know, I don't know for what they would need to do that for. I mean, how many millions do you need? You know what I mean? That part I don't know, can't see. I really can't comment on it, just because it's not like I saw them constantly in different cars and in, you know, owning 20 houses and just spending everybody's money. I mean, I saw them dressed in jeans and a regular T-shirt and
Let me ask you the other question that kind of goes along with this. If Full Tilt does come back under the Group Bernard Tapie, they won't be back in the States, but they'll be back in the rest of the world, and you live in Vancouver, so you can play on any site that you want. Would you play on Full Tilt if it comes back to life?
Well, if they pay everybody back, absolutely. You know, to me, it is important for me that they or at least strike a deal. You know, if they strike a deal saying we don't have the money immediately, but we're paying it all back. We have a plan intact that looks like, to me, it's acceptable. Absolutely. Why wouldn't I? They've never, to me, done anything wrong. So to say, yes, there's been a delay on their money, and if they make good on that, or the intentions are good, then I have no problems, playing on Full Tilt. In that matter, I mean, obviously, if they just open up shop and ignored everybody, which they wouldn't do, but if something like that happened, yeah, then I would probably not be one of the supporters, because obviously I believe in doing the right things.
Well, I got so many more questions. We're going to have you on again. There's no doubt about it. I haven't got down through a quarter of the questions I had for you here. Let's move away to something a little more pleasant to talk about than the Full Tilt one. Got a question for you. On your website, you talk about finding your inner maniac. This is a total question. What exactly do you mean by finding your inner maniac?
And how inner is it for you, Greg?
Well, I didn't really want... I mean, this is back when I was in the hospital days. No, I'm just kidding. No, when I used to play, like, the small stakes poker a lot, I mean, part of the reason I was successful and part of the reason how I built my bankroll and that sort of thing is it's very difficult to do. The more notoriety you get and the more publicity you get and you know, ego, popularity, these types of things sometimes can take over and just the lifestyle and wanting to make more money. But I was really good at in the past in watching the big No Limit game filled with the rock stars like Antonio and Phil Lack and, you know, all the household names were playing in it, and I would play in the games below it that weren't roped off and nobody would watch, and I was the rock star at the table, and I would just have everybody covered, and I would just splash every single pot, and it would get to the point where I would just always be splashing and raising and raising and raising, and people that, you know, didn't really know me that well or know what was going on would just get so sick of it that, you know, they would see you've raised 38 hands in a row, and all of a sudden they'd find themselves putting their entire stack in preflop with two tens or jacks when I would have the aces or the kings, and, you know, be like, only you, because it's you, you're a maniac. You know, when if people know how I play, I'm really not a maniac at all, but it's just the fact that I'm playing in much, much smaller games where my bankroll is so sufficient and I'm overbuying in that I can kind of run them over, and so when I'm betting, you know, if I'm playing 2-5 No Limit and I'm betting $30 on every single flop, it appears that I'm a maniac and that's my image. But if I put in 5,000 preflop, you know, 500 big blinds, there's probably a good chance that I have a little bit better than 210.
There you go. Well, Greg, we really appreciate having you on. As Dennis said, we'll have to have you back because you're a terrific guest, and we really appreciate you making time and hope that your time there at the Commerce is as profitable as possible.
Thanks a lot, boys. I'll be happy to be on any time. You guys are a lot of fun.
Thank you. Greg Mueller.
Take care, Greg.
You can follow him on Twitter at GregFBT. And I'm sorry we have to rush him off, but we got a few minutes left in the show, and we want to get to our other guest, who we kind of have to squeeze into the last 5 minutes. And, Dennis, you can introduce him.
Yeah, I apologize for that. I talked to Jamie, and he was willing to come on. It's Jamie Gold, the gentleman who won the 2006 main event, the World Series of Poker, that has the coveted bracelet. And Jamie is going to be joining me this weekend at the Heartland Poker Tour up at the Peppermill in Reno, and is also conducting a seminar. So welcome to the final table, Jamie.
No, thanks for having me.
I was just asking, what have you been up to? You been playing much poker?
I have not been playing a lot of poker. I played at the Legends at the Bike in L.A. Other than that, I've just been working. We're going to be announcing a few new business ventures over the next couple of weeks, and I'm excited to get back to playing. I'll be with you guys in Reno, so I think it'll be a really good time.
Excellent. And I think you're going to be ducking on December 2nd from noon to 6. You're going to have a seminar.
It's a 6-hour seminar. It's the first time I've ever done something like this, and you know, I feel like I have a lifetime of information to impart. I don't always use all that information, you know. So I say more do as I play, do as I say, not as I play. But I feel like I've learned from all the best poker players in the world, and at least the best that I've ever seen. And I really want to share that information with people. And very often, you know, there are some great boot camps and seminars out there, but a lot of them cost anywhere from, you know, $600 to $2,100 sometimes. And so I wanted to make it really affordable for people and also not make it a two-day stretch, so that basically within 6 hours I feel like I can give you so much information, especially if you're playing on, you know, a smaller bankroll where you're playing for somewhere between, you know, $200 to $1,000 every time you sit down at a poker table. I feel like, you know, I can definitely give people the information to help them master that game and make them really profitable and stop making the mistakes that they usually make. You know, you cut out one $20 mistake that you're doing 10 times a night, it sounds like a $200 save, but it's not. As you know, that's, you know, $200 in your stack that then can turn into $400, which makes that a $600 save. So the littlest things that you fix in your game, that's tiniest leaks, can actually become super profitable for you. And that's what I want to try to help people do.
Will bluffing and talking to your opponent be parts of what you're teaching?
Yes, but not the main focus. It'll be as much as a focus as I believe that any player should have in their game, but it won't be the focus. I'm not trying to teach people how to play like I play. Again, I've been very fortunate. I may have had a larger bankroll than most people will ever have. I'm not trying to teach people how to do what I did. I'm trying to teach them, you know, I've read just about every book that I've heard was worthwhile, and I've played with most of the best players in the world, many of which nobody's ever heard of. But I feel like I have such a wealth of information, and I want to share it with people. But again, I do not want to teach people how to play the way that I play, because it will probably not be profitable for most people, and very often not profitable for me. It's more about fun. But I want to make people, you know, give them at least the opportunity to be really serious poker players. So I'm charging $300. I want to make this available to everybody. And anybody who's playing at any level, if you're risking at least $200 at any given time in a poker game, if you're not willing to spend $300 to learn how to make that game better, then you're just not taking the game that seriously. And if you know everything about the game, then please teach me.
That last phrase is a words of wisdom, and I agree with that. If you're not continually learning this game, you're going to be left in the dust, because it's always changing and you can always improve. I might sneak into the back corner of your room while you're doing that, if that's all right, for a little while.
I would be honored to have you there, and you know, afterwards I'm sure a lot of people would love to ask what we're going to do at the end. Maybe you could just be a guest of honor. We're going to do a Q&A, so if you could come, say, for the last hour. And then, of course, come in any time. But even in the last hour, I would love to be there, because I'm sure there's a lot of questions that people would like to ask you. These are not supposed to be questions about us personally, but actually poker questions, so that, you know, you're not just coming to hear me speak, teach you everything that I feel like you should know about poker, but rather ask the questions that you've always wanted to ask. You know, I'm no, by no means perfect, and I may have left something out. I know I'll give them an incredible wealth of information, but you may be better suited to answer a question than I am, and I would love to have you there.
All right, that's this Friday at the Peppermill in Reno, part of the Heartland Poker Tour weekend. Dennis will be there. Jamie's going to be doing his seminar. And, Jamie, we'll have to have a longer discussion with you sometime to catch up on everything else that's going on. But thanks for jumping in for just a few minutes today.
I would love to. Yeah, we're going to make some big announcements in the next 5 days. So I'd love to come back on. I really appreciate it. You guys do a phenomenal job.
Thank you so much. 2006 world champion Jamie Gold joining us here at the final table. Unfortunately, Dennis, we're all out of time, so I'll let you run off to Reno for the weekend while I get ready for the Gateway Poker Classic here at Harrah's St. Louis. For those of you who want the schedule, you can click the blog, the Final Table Show blog, on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. That's also where you can get our podcasts, not just this, but all 149 of the shows that we have done so far are available right there and via iTunes. Have a great weekend in Reno, Dennis.
All right, you take care, Paul.
And thanks to Jamie and Greg for joining us. From Harrah's St. Louis and Las Vegas, this is the Final Table Poker Radio Show on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.